Moncrief on News Talk.
Christopher Nolan has had an impressive career as a movie director, and of course Oppenheimer now has 7 Oscars, but there's one film he made that you won't have seen because it was essentially never released. Darren Mooney is a specialist in Christopher Nolan's films and the author of Christopher Nolan, A Critical Study of the Films. Afternoon, Darren.
Good afternoon, Sean. How are things?
Not too bad. So tell us about this film in particular.
So this film is Larceny. It is the second short film that he worked on. So Nolan, as most of people are aware, one of the great defining directors of our generation, came to a lot of people's awareness through Memento, the film released in 2000, 2001, starring Guy Pearce. Before that, he had made a feature film called Following. As he referenced, you can find that if you look hard enough. I have a copy that's a Czech DVD imported of it. But before that, he had studied English literature at University College London, and he had turned the film studio there basically into his own private film studio. And he produced a number of short films, the first of which was Tarantella, which he produced in 1989, which you can find in the deepest, darkest bowels of the internet if you go look. And then later he produced Doodlebug, which is a surrealist film, which is available on various special edition copies of his later films. The film that you referenced is Larceny, which is the second of his 3 student films, and it is one that has disappeared completely off the face of the planet. It was shot in 1995. It premiered at the Cambridge Film Festival in 1996. It gained rapturous reviews. It's roundly regarded as one of the best films to come out of the University College London Film Society, but nobody has seen it since, which is absolutely fascinating.
That is fascinating, because one's first assumption would be, well, you know, it wasn't that great. He was only starting out. So, you know, why muddy his filmography by letting that one be released? But if you say it got rave reviews, though.
Yes, I mean, this is kind of interesting. I think I have talked to Jeremy Theobald, who is the star of that movie. He's gone on. He was the leading man in Doodlebug, the short that followed, and he was the leading actor in Following, Nolan's first feature film. He's also subsequently appeared in cameo roles in Batman Begins, and he played the snooty waiter in Tenet, if you're an eagle-eyed viewer of that film. I talked to him about the production of it, and he basically said, from his point of view, he suspects that Nolan was working on some tricks that he kind of would hone in later productions that he maybe didn't want to share, that he didn't want his later work to be colored by the reaction to this film, or for people to go back and go, ah, there's a more primitive version of the technique that he would use in Following, the technique he would use in Memento. So what we do know about Larceny, and we know very little about Larceny, it is an 8-minute long short. It was apparently shot over the course of a weekend. It's shot on 16mm film, and it is apparently about a break-in. Now, what we also know about Following, which is Nolan's first feature-length film, is that that is a movie also about a break-in, but it was inspired directly by a break-in that happened to Nolan while he was living in London, and how profoundly he felt affected by that. So if I were a guessing man, and based on what Mr. Theobald has told me, I suspect that Larceny may be a blueprint for that. It may be Nolan working through early drafts of the ideas that would become his first feature, you know?
Right, okay. Is it relatively easy, though, to make a film disappear like that?
Well, I think you've got to keep in mind this is a student society, so this is not necessarily an institution that keeps a great deal of records. This is also the late 90s, so we don't have digital copies yet. And stuff isn't really stored on kind of hard drives at this point. Also, as listeners who are even casually familiar with Nolan will know, who watched the Oscars last night, and who watched, like, Hoyt van Hoytema accepting the Oscar for cinematography, Nolan is a director who likes analog. He doesn't really like digital. So he would have shot all this on film. So the copy of this that exists is likely a physical copy. I know that David Julien, who is Nolan's composer, he worked with Nolan in that film society. He worked with him composing the score for Following. He also composed the score for Memento and later on The Prestige. I know that Julien has a physical copy of it on VHS. I also know that Julien will not show it to anybody because he understands that Nolan doesn't want it to be shown. So I think it is a snapshot of a particular moment. Like, this is something that happened just at the right time. Had it been 10 years later, somebody somewhere would have a copy of a .movie or .mp4 file they could share online. But because this was at a time when, you know, you had to have a VHS to see the thing, it was a lot easier to make it disappear, I think.
Right. And those student works that you have seen, are they very Christopher Nolan-y?
They are, in the sense that, like, you can see a clear line between, like, what Nolan does as a student and what he develops as a later filmmaker. To pick an obvious example, his first feature film, Following, which he shot over a series of weekends, which he regards as a series of short films that he stitched together into a movie. The lead character in that is called Cobb. The lead character in Nolan's movie Inception, played by Leonardo DiCaprio, is also called Cobb. The movie Doodlebug, which I referenced, the Surrealist short, which you can find with a quick Google, it's readily available. That is a movie which is kind of Kafka-esque, but it's built on this idea of recursion. It's an apartment within an apartment within an apartment. A guy squashes a bug and then looks up to see a giant foot coming down to squash him. That, if you've heard that premise, it doesn't sound too dissimilar from the idea of dreams within Inception. Or, if you want to get more literal, the rooms within rooms at the climax of Interstellar. I think Nolan is a director who kind of emerged relatively fully formed. Hell, even if you look at his finished films, if you look at, like, Memento, which is generally regarded as his first full complete film, the opening shot of that movie features a murder happening in reverse. Glass is rising from the ground and going back on the head of the person who's been shot, a gun casing rising off the floor, flying back into the gun so the bullet is reversed backwards. That's Tenet. That's Tenet in the opening 60 seconds of Nolan's first film. So I think, yes, I think Nolan's, it's very easy to see a clear connection between, you know, the guy who was making student films with his friends in the late 90s and the guy who just won Best Picture and Best Director at the Academy Awards.
Yeah. It's interesting, though, I mean, because he seems to have put an awful lot of work into the technical aspects of filmmaking, even from those early days, yet... Is that's the case? He doesn't have a mobile phone. He's kind of allergic to anything digital.
He is. And then again, this is one of the things where you look at Nolan and you don't want to psychoanalyze a director, I say, right before we psychoanalyze a director. But they would talk about, like, when he was working at the University College London, he would do things like he would shoot through a fishbowl in order to get a distorted lens effect. He's very interested in, like, the physics of lens and the exposure of film to light and stuff like that. And I think if you look at his films throughout his filmography, there's this preoccupation narratively, not even just in terms of the construction, the technical side of it, with the idea of what is real and what is physical and what can be held. There's a moment in Memento where Guy Pearce, who is a man who has no memory, no sense of identity, no sense of connection to the world outside himself, like, explains how he navigates the world. And he says, I know because when I pick up this plate, I know what it's going to feel like. I know when I knock on this table, what it's going to sound like. And I do think if you look at how Nolan talks about digital and his concerns about the way that digital can be manipulated and altered. And look, we all live in an era of deep fakes. We know that the digital image is something that can be easily edited and easily controlled in a way the physical media can't. Nolan's talked about how, like, he loves IMAX, but he hates 3D. And the reason that he hates 3D is because, from Nolan's perspective, somebody sitting in an audience can see an image in a way that he can't control. And that fundamentally bothers him as a filmmaker. So I think, like, the idea of Nolan's preoccupation with physicality is control. And I think his reluctance to engage with digital material is very much tied to, as you said, that idea of the director who doesn't have an email, who doesn't have a smartphone, who, you know, we see the photos of him wandering around with an old viewfinder hanging from his neck, drinking a flask of tea, you know?
Mm. That is so interesting. If you had to predict, I mean, the list of movies that he's made up until Oppenheimer, many of them, as you've already pointed out, have similar concerns or similar themes. Does Oppenheimer fit in within that?
I would argue that it very much does. In a broad thematic sense, obviously it's a film about the unraveling of time. It's a film that takes place in several time periods simultaneously. You're cutting across the past and the present, the lecture that leads to the bomb, the interrogation of the bomb afterwards. That's very much how Nolan's films approach the idea of time. But thematically, Nolan's films are preoccupied with the idea of the unraveling of cause and effect. The idea that we live in a world that is, to get back to that question you raised about, like, physical film and digital film, a world where we're uncertain what is real, what is tactile, and what is tangible. So to pick an obvious example, Memento is about a man who cannot form memories. So he doesn't know what he just did or what he's going to do next. All he knows is what he's experiencing in that moment. But you look at bigger pictures. Inception is about a man who's trapped within dreams, who doesn't know whether he's living inside a dream or whether it's real or whether it's fake. Obviously, the Batman is the story of a rich guy who dresses up as a bat because he can't confront the reality of his parents' death. Interstellar is about the distortion of time, all that sort of stuff. Oppenheimer, at its core, is a movie about quantum physics. And I think it's remarkable. It's a nearly billion-dollar movie about quantum physics that just won Best Picture. But central to the idea of quantum physics is, and I apologize if I'm boring yourself or your listeners, Sean, the transition from an idea of Newtonian cause and effect, action and reaction. If I do this, I know I will get the following consequence from it, to a world of possibilities and probabilities, where, you know, in Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, you can know either where a particle is or where it's moving, but you cannot know both at the same time. So you cannot ever know anything. And throughout Oppenheimer, there's this idea of Oppenheimer himself being unsure what he thinks, what he feels, how his work is going to be used, whether he's working on theory or whether or not he's going to cause something that he cannot control. And I think that if you look at it that way, Oppenheimer is very much of a piece with movies like Memento, The Prestige, the Batman trilogy, in that it is a story about how in a world where we cannot control everything, where we cannot know everything, where we don't know what is real, we still have a moral obligation or responsibility for our own actions. Yeah. It's not something rooted simply in consequence. I think it is part of that filmography.
Darren, a question from one of our listeners, and it's a more prosaic point. Why are the actors' voices muffled sounding in Nolan's films? Is it a deliberate choice?
Okay, it's a very good question. People ask it quite commonly. If you want to get into this, the argument is more broadly that Nolan likes an experiential sound mix. He likes a sound mix that puts you in a position where, to quote Tenet, the movie that he made before Oppenheimer, don't try to understand it, just feel it. And Nolan generally treats dialogue as somewhat expendable. It is a sound effect rather than a literal kind of plot mechanic. So if you are going to a film that Nolan makes, he wants you to experience. It doesn't necessarily matter what the characters are shouting at one another as the action builds around them. It just matters that you feel the urgency in what they're shouting and what they're feeling. So Nolan has kind of like, when he began, he was regarded as a director who was very good at exposition, very good at explaining things to audiences. As he's gone along, he's tried to kind of push himself and become more broad in how he tells his stories. The great example of this is the movie Dunkirk, which he made before Tenet, where he hopefully was joking, but suggested that he wanted to make a movie without a script. So the idea was that you would have a movie where you didn't know the name of many of the characters. Cillian Murphy's character in Dunkirk never gets a name. Mm-hmm. He's just the shivering sailor. Or you would have a movie where, you know, there is no briefing scene. You know, the classic war movie briefing scene where there's a map and a man tells you we're going from here to here. That isn't in Dunkirk either. Nolan wants to push away from this idea of explaining to audience through words what is happening and instead demonstrating through, you know, both the way his actors perform. And it's very telling that, like, with Oppenheimer, if you look at Cillian Murphy, who is one of his great long-term collaborators, one of his great partners, the secret weapon of Oppenheimer, a movie shot in IMAX, is not necessarily like these huge vistas or these gigantic explosions. It's Nolan taking an IMAX camera and pushing it in the face of Cillian Murphy and trusting Cillian Murphy's face and his eyes to express what the character is feeling inside himself. Mm. But also even the idea of just letting the sensation of a movie roll through you, sitting in a theater seat and feeling the rumble in your bones and feeling the propulsive power of cinema. That is, I think, what Nolan's getting at with his sound mixes.
Yeah, and plus also, I suppose, that's a very good example of what you were talking about in Cillian Murphy's face. One of the things he was so good at was expressing two different emotions simultaneously, often contradictory emotions.
Absolutely. I mean, my favorite fact about like the Murphy-Nolan bromance is Nolan wanted to cast him in Batman Begins. He auditioned him for the role of Batman. He eventually got the role of Scarecrow Jonathan Crane. And if you watch Batman Begins, you'll notice that Jonathan Crane has glasses that he keeps taking off and putting on, often in the same scene. And the reason for that is because Nolan noticed that Cillian Murphy had, and I quote here, the most beautiful eyes, and wanted to draw the audience's attention to those eyes. So if you're ever watching Batman Begins again, wondering why Cillian Murphy keeps putting on and taking off glasses, it's because Nolan loves those baby blue eyes.
Someone else has sent in a question. I hope this means something to you. Ask your guest his theory on the truth of Memento.
Okay, interesting. I don't necessarily know precisely if I personally have a theory about the meaning of Memento, but I think that Memento is, obviously that's Nolan's first film, or his first big film. It's the first film that broke out after Following. And it's a movie that happens kind of backwards. And you have this idea of like what is real and what is fake. And I think that there is some discussion around the ambiguity of the ending of that movie. The question of what the audience just saw, how much of it is true, and how much of it is a narrative that the character constructs to make sense of the world around them. Classic recurring Nolan motif. It's a huge part of, say, Inception, for example, where the ending of Inception is still controversial. Is Cobb still in a dream at the end of Inception? I don't know if it's a spoiler to ask a question I'm not going to answer, but that's the kind of point there. And Memento has something similar. And I think Nolan himself has talked about how he doesn't like giving concrete answers. When he premiered Memento at the Venice Film Festival in September 2000, he did an interview with an Italian press agent, and the press agent asked about the ending to Memento. And Nolan very calmly, very gently, very sophisticatedly laid out what he, as the filmmaker, thought had happened, but also said at the end, the important thing is that you watch it and you reach a conclusion yourself. And my favorite detail about that is that immediately after he did that, his brother Jonathan whacked him on the head and said, "You bonehead, you never answer a question like that." And so Nolan, ever since then, has generally refused to answer questions about the ending of the movie, instead leaving it up to the audience. And I think if you ask me my theory about the ending of Memento or the meaning of Memento, the idea is that we all construct our own meaning. And that includes the character in the movie and the audience watching at home.
What's next for Christopher Nolan?
No idea yet. He's a director who very famously works on one film at a time. Even when he made the Batman trilogy with Warner Brothers, he was only contracted for one film at a time, which gave him great negotiating leverage. He was only able to make Inception because they needed him to sign on to make a third Batman movie, for example. So I don't know if even Nolan himself knows for sure what his next project's going to be, but I can guarantee you it's going to be big. The big question is where that movie is going to be. Because very famously, he was a company man for Warner Brothers from his third film, that's Insomnia, onwards, up until Tenet. After the botched release of Tenet, he moved over to Universal. Universal gave him carte blanche and won him Best Picture and Best Director Oscar. There are rumors that Warner Brothers want to get him back, that they've been kind of seducing him, asking him to come back to the lot to work on post-production for Oppenheimer, giving him a bonus check that he was entitled to anyway for Tenet, which doesn't sound like that much of a nice thing to do. It just seems what you're legally obligated to do. But there is some suggestion that Warners are trying to woo him back. So I imagine Nolan himself is going to take a breather and figure out what he wants to do next. So I can't answer that question for you, Sean, unfortunately.
Yeah, probably neither can he at the moment. Darren, thank you very much for speaking with us today. That was Darren Mooney there, columnist with the Irish Independent and the author of Christopher Nolan, A Critical Study of the Films.
Moncrief, weekdays at 2 p.m. on News Talk.